Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
That's the way I like it, baby. I don't wanna live forever. And don't forget the Joker.
Motorhead, Ace of Spades.
Wake up!
As soon as that bass comes in at the beginning, I know we're talking about bass already in this
really?
Show. Yes.
Good 10 out of 10. Carry
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. With his pick and his Marshall stack, was it 415s and a 4x12 on top of it or something? His Rickenbacker, it grinds. It's like a ripsaw going through a piece of wood. It rips through the whole fabric of that song.
Yeah, and it makes you have like this Aardman animation kind of groan, like Wallace and Gromit. You're just there going, ah.
When I heard this on the radio for the first time, I was completely blown away because, of course, Motorhead started in the mid-70s, really.
Yeah.
So they were sort of before punk. And a lot of people said that, you know, they really inspired a lot of punk music because it was so aggressive, but it had solos in it. It had guitar solos, and it was actually rock and roll. It was, but speed metal, a lot of other things have come from Motorhead. But it's the aggression and the ferocity of the performance that always gets me.
Yeah.
You know?
That was 1980 as well.
Oh, that's 80, right. So that's that just after that sort of post the punk thing. Really,
yeah,
wasn't
well, it was Ace of. This is their fourth album, though.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're right. Because they had a couple of albums before, and their first ever album they recorded on parole was actually shelved.
Was it?
Back in 1976, because it was deemed uncommercial or unviable from a commercial point of view.
Right.
Yeah.
Blimey.
Weird, eh? That's... Isn't it funny about the stories behind what goes on?
Yeah.
I mean, it's always easy to look back and go, oh, yeah, that happened and we know. But, you know, when you're actually in the middle of it, like right now, I was saying this to someone the other day, like right now, we don't really know what we're in the middle of.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to look with hindsight and go, oh, yeah, that was happening. there was a scene.
But when you're there, you don't realize it's there. Apparently, you know, like the 60s. I mean, I can't obviously remember it, but it was all happening in London, really. It wasn't happening up north. It only happened, and it happened very quickly, you know. It's like this huge swinging 60s thing. It wasn't all that long. And anyway, back to Motorhead.
Yes.
They're all dead now, sadly.
It's really weird you should say that.
The original band, anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
You know. Fast Eddie.
Yeah.
Lemmy. And that documentary on Lemmy is one of the best ones. We do watch it. We've watched it a few times, haven't we?
Yeah. It's quite comforting, actually. I'm so glad that he recorded that. He did that video because it kind of... He hasn't left the building, if you know what I mean. He's still around.
When he was cooking those chips in his...
when you see the outtakes, he had to clean his kitchen up before they could do the shoot that. Yeah, because it was a bit of a mess.
But he was in that rent-controlled apartment, you know, wasn't he? Really close to, was it Sunset Strip, I think? And it was, amazing. Absolutely amazing documentary.
You should watch it if you haven't seen it.
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
Just brilliant. And what I really... you could see through the interviews that he's given over the years as well, when I come across the odd interviews, I was researching this as well, that he was into Fruit Machines from a very early age, and he said he was quite inspired by that. But, you know, some of the lyrics that he wrote, ever influenced by Fruit Machines, slot machines.
Well, I think my favourite title of all of them is Killed by Death. Which I think is the best song title I have ever heard.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah, it's
really?
Killed by Death, and it is a fantastic song title.
That's well.
No.
Take her for granted. She had a hard time. Don't misunderstand her. I'll play with her mind. Treat her so gently. Got to know she's
Sensitive Kind by J.J. Cale.
Wonderful artist. He's very important.
I was going to say he's one of the most important figures in rock music, isn't he, really? In the history of rock.
Yeah, I mean, he wrote, and most of his success, financial success, I suppose, came from other people recording his material, because After Midnight was recorded by Eric Clapton, and of course, Cocaine, recorded by Clapton, so that must have made him a bob or two, the old lad, you know?
Yeah, good on him. That's great. And,
but that, you know, that in its own right, I think, is a great song. You know, with him playing guitar and singing, he's got such a relaxed style, and his guitar is really super laid back. He doesn't play too many notes. Very sensitive, you know.
Yeah, that was released in 1979. His fifth album, from the album called Five.
Surprisingly enough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Did you notice I did notice, though, because I'm listening through headphones, that the vocals were double-tracked. You could hear there was almost like a slight pan, almost. You know, it just felt slightly odd.
Yeah.
But then it just felt of a time when that was quite a regular practice. It dated it, in a way, in the sound.
Yeah, he was actually an electronics engineer, a studio engineer. Yeah. Because when he didn't want to wield a gun in the forces when he was drafted, so he went and became an electronics engineer.
Yeah, in the Air Force, yeah.
Yeah, and then he carried that through to the studio later on.
Yeah.
Did he start off his career or something, and he ended up not making it, so he went back home to Tulsa, is it?
It didn't happen very easily for him, no. He did. He went over to... He used to play regularly at the Whiskey A Go-Go. What a venue.
Yeah, what a venue.
You hear so many stories. And apparently, he had to change his name, and there was a guy called Elmer Valentine. Elmer Valentine said to him, why don't you call yourself J.J. Cale instead of John Cale, because then you won't get confused with John Cale from the Velvet Underground. Yeah. So basically, he was out there in L.A., found little success, and he recorded a couple of demos, which did nothing, really. So he sold his guitar and moved back to Tulsa. Carried on playing, but...
And I just wonder, because a guy that we met when we were in Nashville, a guy called Danny Flowers, he wrote Tulsa Time.
Yeah.
And I just wonder whether it's anything to do with J.J. Cale. It might not have, I might be completely wrong, but it's like it's a funny thing, because there's a connection, isn't there? Because Monty Hitchcock, who used to be Emily Harris's manager, we stayed with him when we were over there, and he was like, cool, we got very drunk, didn't we, and stuff, and... it was, very, very, a very nasty business indeed. Yeah. In that Mexican restaurant.
But you find that it's just about a big family. That's the thing. You fly halfway around the world and you end up with the family that are your friends, and that it's their friends, and then everyone's connected and hanging out. And that's what I love.
Yeah.
Music family, really.
Yeah.
So when we went and saw that rehearsal that Danny was playing in with Sweethearts of the Rodeo.
That's right.
And Danny, then you said, oh yeah, he wrote, Danny wrote Tulsa Time.
And you think, holy shit.
Yeah. Kind of. Well, I just sat there grinning like a fool, because you just go, great. Yeah. You know, because to me, everybody's human, you know, so I kind of, I celebrate success, fantastically so, but I don't think it really sinks in, you know. Yeah. It's like for me standing next to Robert Plant in a bar when I was growing up and thinking nothing of it. And then later on you just go, oh, I should have said hello, really, and strike up a conversation. But going back to J.J. Cale and Nashville and Danny, it is...
He did most of the recording in Nashville, didn't he?
Yeah.
J.J. Cale.
Neil Young said of J.J. Cale as well, which I think is beautiful. He said, of all the players I've ever heard, it's got to be Jimi Hendrix and J.J. Cale who are the best electric guitar players.
Wow.
Yeah. Interesting, eh?
Oh yeah, I'm
Spencer Davis Group and Keep On Running. Steve Winwood, he was 16 when he did that. Was he 15? I can't remember. Something ridiculous.
I don't want to know.
Yeah. What an incredibly talented bloke. We love Steve Winwood. He's ace in all respects.
He is.
And he's got a fiendishly high voice. That's one thing you always think about him.
I do. And also, his brother's got a great name. Muff.
Yes. Muff Winwood. You got red.
Well, I haven't.
You have?
Actually, I've just realised the other meaning of that word. Sorry.
Well, Muff, he went to be a very successful record executive, of course.
Of course.
And he was instrumental in getting Wishbone Ash away. He was the manager of
Never.
He was indeed, yeah.
So that, I've heard that name before, you see. I've heard about Muff Winwood.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's a giant of the industry. But he was playing bass on that. But what I love about that, more than anything, I love Steve Winwood's voice. It's a great song, of course. Not written by them. Who wrote it?
A reggae musician and songwriter called Jackie Edwards.
Blimey.
Fantastic.
That's amazing.
It's really good, eh? And also, it was in the film Run, Fat Boy, Run. That's okay. Where I remembered it from as well.
And this was produced, was it not, by Chris Blackwell?
That's who right, started Island Records.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He was saying that he got a loan from Scala Brown Associates for the single by offering a sizable share of his label as security. And the success of this song meant that he was able to repay the loan, like, trade pronto.
Big balls.
Yeah, and it was number one in the UK singles chart in January 1966.
Fantastic. What a great song. But just coming on to fuzz guitar.
Okay,
because the other thing about that is the marvellous sound of that fuzz guitar. Very thin, very fuzzy, very aggressive. But it really, it had such impact. As soon as it comes in, it's very dramatic, isn't it? Mm. It's like a real fizzing fuzz, you know? Great.
I like that song. It energises you. It makes you feel good.
It does.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, of thorns upon my liar's chair, full of broken thoughts I cannot repair. Beneath the stains of time, the feelings disappear. You are someone else, I am still right here. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end. And you could have it all, my empire of dirt. I will let you down, I will make you hurt. If I could start again, a million miles away, I would keep myself, I would find a way.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
You don't sound like him.
I know. That was Hurt.
Incredible. Written by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, who, after watching the video and listening to it, he's said the song was no longer his. Which, you know, what a performance. And this is the last album that Johnny Cash ever recorded.
Yeah.
With Rick Rubin at the helm.
Say that again. Rick Rubin.
Yes, Rick. Oh, not the release. What are we again? Rick Rubin. Yes, Rick Rubin at helm as producer.
Right.
Stripped back, beautiful arrangement, and the power as it gets towards the end there with that piano, just doing that. You know, those singles and the chords are sort of going underneath, but he's hitting that note at the top there, and it's just so powerful. What a beautiful, and it's delivery. 87 albums. This was his 87th studio album.
I don't want to talk to you anymore.
Johnny
really?
Cash, 87
I did not know
albums.
That.
Yeah.
Well, that's some innings. That's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know how old he was when he died, Johnny Cash, I should do. But, you know, 87 albums, that means he's doing a fair few a year, you know?
Yeah. And I think he also crossed over a lot, didn't he? So he was country, he was blues, he was... gospel. So he was one of those rare crossover artists of the time, I think, as well, which really probably helped with his with all those albums.
Well, yeah, bloody hell.
Do you know what I love about him though? He's so simple. His vocal delivery is honest. It's simple, as in, yeah, it's simple. I don't know how to express it. I'm
a
bit lost for words.
Acrobatics. I mean, now we've got a generation of a couple of generations of musicians and vocalists that are, in my opinion, oversinging. They oversing, they add too many notes.
They over-egg the pudding.
They certainly do. You listened to J.J. Cale earlier on, and he was fantastic. Did he over-egg it? No. He was virtually whispering the song, but it was beautiful. It just sat in the mix lovely, you know? And then you got Lemmy. The beginning there, and he's screaming his balls off, but, you know, he wasn't over-singing. He wasn't putting loads of extra notes in. He was delivering the song. And I think that's what Johnny Cash was a master at. And I think this particular one, it's one of my favourite... and the film, you know, was great with Joaquin Phoenix, wasn't he?
Yeah, Walk the Line.
Yeah, amazing film. And we've got it in a plaque downstairs because
Keira
Kilgallen bought it for a wedding present for us.
That's right.
Because You're Mine, We Walk the Line.
I know, it's great.
Yeah, it's lovely.
Well, did you know as well that David Bowie sang this as a duet with Trent as well?
I did not.
Yeah, yeah. So I think quite a few people have sung this song over the years because it's so beautifully crafted.
Well, Trent Reznor himself, I mean, he's a real good bloke, you know. I mean, he does an awful lot of stuff. Very, very good musician and very good instrumentalist, you know. He plays all sorts of stuff and, you know, you keep seeing him popping up in all these studio exposés, you know, and he's there and he's up to his alligators in bloody, in keyboards and loads of outboard stuff and he's great, you know. But Rick Rubin has got a mixed reputation, the producer, because a lot of people have said that he actually does nothing. And I can't remember which band it was now, where he said he used to come in for like half an hour and just listen, not say anything, and walk out again. And he was getting paid a fortune to do it. And I just can't remember which band it was, actually. But I think perhaps in that half an hour, him just being there, because he has produced some incredible records, Rick Rubin, you know. He's also very hairy. He's a hairy looking, which is good, you know, for a producer. You've got to be hairy, I think, to be a producer.
Proper. I think sometimes, though, with the role of the producer, when we looked into it and we were really thinking about the psychology with our own studio, was that you're there to you don't get involved until they're stuck. You allow the band to evolve, the artist to evolve, don't you? So really, it's your job to come in when the artist gets stuck. So it could well be that Rick came in and thought, oh, they're getting on great. I don't need to get involved. Because that's partly the psychology. You've got to be really good at working with people to be a great music producer as well.
I think the thing about production as well is it's all about knowing, listening to it, and extending the artist's ability more than they did when they walk in the studio. When they walk out of the studio, a good producer will have extended them beyond where they could do on their own. Where, you know, you just that, no, that's not good enough, let's do it again. Or, you know, let's just deliver that vocal slightly different. Or, you know, let's put some tambourine on or cowbell.
Indeed, more cowbell. Listening to the Supertone Show with Simon Campbell and Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Stevie Wonder remarkable song.
Higher Ground.
Yeah, fantastic. The groove on that, it's monstrous. It's a monstrous groove. It piles in there and it's like, and he played the drums on it. In fact, on the whole album, he played virtually bloody everything. Now, that is just uncalled for. That is too much.
He's just showing off now.
Yeah, it's too much talent.
He's being a bit greedy, I think.
Too much talent for a man. Any man's good. And he used an ARP synth all the way through that, and it was really opened up because they were pretty new at the time, and it opened up. And I think that's that funny sound was done with a Mutron 3, was it? Envelope, filter,
yeah,
I think?
It was.
Yeah. There we are, you see, I knew that. Yeah, I knew that, yeah.
Well, and I know the bass line was played with a Moog synth as well, so...
Yeah, well, it was all, you know, and it's incredible because it's so groovy. And the thing about Stevie Wonder playing drums, because he's partially sighted, his kit was, when you see it set up in the studio, it just looks like someone has just thrown a load of drums on the floor and sort of just... Because he didn't set it up in a way that was conventional because he didn't understand what it should look like because you couldn't see it. So therefore, he just set it up the way he could play it. And as far as I'm concerned, when you hear that, my God, I think he could have had a drum up his bum, you know, and it's absolutely fantastic.
That's 1973 as well.
Well, I had the pleasure the other night of doing a charity gig, and we ran the sound and light, and we put it on, didn't we?
Yeah,
In behalf of a fantastic charity on the island called
Bridge the Gap.
Yeah, Bridge the Gap, and it was called Rock the Gap. This thing, and a lot of young artists were there. And to finish the night off, there's a band called Lava, and the drummer is a guy called Danny Neal. And on the island, man, he's a bit of a legend because everybody sort of looks at him and say he's like the godfather of groove on the island. Well, they did this, and I'm not kidding. He piled in there, and I couldn't believe it was so good. His drumming was fantastic. So there we are. That's a bit of that shout out to Danny Neal, a fantastic drummer.
Yeah,
but,
he is.
You know, back to Stevie Wonder.
Inner Visions. It was written about reincarnation, apparently. Well, you know what? Stevie Wonder was the first ever concert I went to see. I went to see him at the Birmingham NEC back in the day. I don't know when.
Was it the first concert you went to?
Ever. I was 16. So, and I was there. I was there at the four rows from the front, and this big arena going, wow!
I bet you were.
And then he came on. His brother led him on stage, and then his piano kind of moved across the stage. It had like a moving platform. Well, within the first song, I'm there with everybody else, right at the front of the stage, screaming like a mad woman, just going, Stevie! Because... Yeah. I'd never experienced anything of such wonderful groove and musicianship in my life. I was just totally blown away. And so when I got back home, like the following week, I bought all his albums.
Well, as you would do.
As you would do. But because I was just, who is this guy? He's amazing.
Well, I went to see him at Glastonbury. And a few years ago now. And awesome was not... Because his band, I mean, you know, if you're Stevie Wonder, you can ring up anybody and say, excuse me, Stevie Wonder here, will you play on my record? And everybody go,
he didn't even say excuse me.
Well, so he can get anybody he wants. And, you know, but I have never heard a band so tight because, you know, there's loads of them. There's hundreds of the buggers up there, you know?
Yeah.
And there's dancers, there's vocalists, there's percussion players, there's everybody. And, you know, of course... The confusion, if you're in a band, you realise that the confusion level in a band is exponential by the number of people. You know, solo artist, easy, because if you make a mistake, you can cover it yourself. If it's duo, you've both got to cover up. Trio, easy. But when you get a keyboard player and then you start to get more and more musicians involved, everybody's got to be really tight and everybody's got to know exactly what they're doing. Otherwise, you end up with a mess.
And your drummer can't speed up.
Well, absolutely. Well, you know, but these guys, my goodness me, they were unbelievable.
People
Rocking in the Free World, Neil Young from the album Freedom. And it's on twice on that album. There's an acoustic version at the beginning, which actually is my favourite. That nice big drop D with his Martin, just giving it some plenty of stuff there. And then later on with his rock and roll hat on. He does wear like wearing hats, doesn't he?
Neil Young?
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Well, it is, yeah. And I actually thought it was Crazy Horse, actually, that the band who were playing behind them. But it's not. It's a slightly different set of musicians, which is interesting because it does sound very Crazy Horse-ish, really, you know.
Yeah.
Frank Poncho San Pedro, who is this normal guitarist in Crazy Horse, is on there. And on that, he was just singing backing vocals on Keep on Rocking the Free World.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that was recorded at the barn in Woodside.
And Neil Young produced it and engineered it.
Did he really?
He did.
Sorry.
Another one. Very talented chap, I think, old Neil.
Do you know what his middle name is?
No.
Percival.
Percy.
Yeah.
Percy Young.
Yeah.
Hey, Percy, how you doing, lad?
How wonderful is that
name? Can we go for a quick one?
Yeah, I know. It's just like my father's name, Roland. But he was Roland Harold. He had a double
fantastic
whammy of names. But what I love about Neil Young, when I was looking into this song as well, do you know, he worked the folk clubs in Winnipeg when he first started out, and that's when he first met Joni Mitchell.
Ah.
And the folk clubs, and I've started off as a folk artist,
you
and
indeed.
So for me, that was such a beautiful experience and such a naked experience of really embracing the music in such a simple way, really. You break it right back down. You don't have you can't hide behind noise
for
a start.
We know that because we are now doing an unplugged acoustic set.
Yeah.
Of course, it is plugged in because we amplify things, but essentially it's acoustic instruments. And being an electric guitar player, it is terrifying for me because I'm used to having, you know, that plank of wood with an amp and stuff, and you can crank it up if you want. You can actually, but you hit an acoustic guitar hard, and the more you hit it, the harder you pick it, the worse it sounds. You've got to play it real gentle, you know? And it is a terrifying experience, I think, acoustic.
Do you know, when we first started doing the Unplugged, it was, especially as a new bass player, I did find that quite, because I was the singer in my old band, Bigido, and so that was it. And I could just really drift into the song, you know, and it's it just took me over my whole body. I could be in the song. But when I've got this instrument I'm bonding with as well, it's a different experience. But what we say to our the people that we've been playing to recently is like, we're standing here in our underwear, because that's what it feels like.
It does.
It's very
or naked,
exposed.
Actually, completely naked.
Well, yeah.
It is, but, you know, especially for, you know.
But isn't it quite beautiful? Because that means, though, that you can take the song to its to a real points of emotion, and the silence can be used in the creation of the music. It is part of it, and that's what I love about the acoustic set that we do.
Well, Neil Young Unplugged, and I'm sure over the next few weeks we're going to be playing some off that album. We watched the whole video the other night, and the MTV one, and it's astounding. He's such a great acoustic musician. He's in the song. The songs are great, of course, but his performance and the way he plays his acoustic guitar is fantastic. But what I can never grasp is the fact he plays it so sensitively. He plays acoustic so sensitively. And then when he gets an electric guitar around his neck, he goes absolutely bananas.
He's feral, isn't he?
Yeah, and you know, you see him, and he was that Bob Dylan's big birthday party up with Eric Clapton and all those guys, and Ronnie Wood, and the rest of the Stones there, and I think Steve Winwood was on. There's loads of them, yeah. And he came to do a solo, and he's like down, and he's crunching guitar, and Eric Clapton looked positively frightened. he looked over and thinking, oh no, what's happening here?
Everyone was so well behaved, and then Neil Young cranks up, it's like,
wah! And it's going, you know. And what nobody really realises about Neil Young, unless you're a guitar player, is he uses a tiny amp on stage. He uses a little Tweed Deluxe. They're only about 12 watts on full. And that's what it sounds like. But it's incredible, you know. He has this old Les Paul Black Beauty, beautiful, you know, great. But I like his playing. And I saw something on Facebook the other day who said he shouldn't have an electric guitar and he shouldn't play solos. Well, I completely disagree, because he's great. He picks great notes and he creates a fantastic racket with that electric guitar. He might not be Matt Scofield, he might not be Robin Ford, he might not be Nwangi Malmsteen, but I'll tell you one thing, I know who I would rather listen to.
Family, and a song called Burlesque. Now, I never knew about Family. You introduced me to this band.
Well, they're a remarkable band. I mean, they are. Roger Chapman's voice is incredible. Always has been. Very high.
It's very distinctive.
Very tight vibrato, yeah. And his style is so unusual. And they were forgotten about, Family, really. And they're one of those bands that should deserve more credit, you know? And that's why we're playing that, because we love this song.
Yeah.
What I like about it, I particularly like the fact that it's chaotic, in the fact that if you break the parts down, it sounds like they're all playing different songs. But when you stick them all together, it's beautiful. And the mix and the groove and the whole thing and the, you know, and we've played this, haven't we?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's,
I love
it's,
playing it. I get my short scale.
It's such a great, you like big grunting short scale sound. Yeah. You know, it's tricky doing it with one guitar, because obviously you can't do both parts because there's an interplay between the two.
Yeah.
But it's a great song, very unusual, you know?
No, I find it quite bizarre. And I feel like I'm Alice in Wonderland when I play that song.
Yeah.
And when I listen to it, it's actually, it just feels very complex, yet simple.
Yeah.
But it's complex.
But it's all to do with that groove, and the parts are so intricate, they've really got to be played properly, you know. It's really got to understand what you're doing with it. Great song, though. Great song. Great band.
Well, they were formed in late 66 in Leicester, and they played at the Marquee and the 100 Club and the famous Sibilia's in Swallow Street. And this, it's Sibilia's, I've never heard of this place before. They met Henrietta Guinness, who introduced them into society.
No.
Oh, yes, darling.
In Leicester?
No, in London. Oh. Big banana.
Well, because they've been from Leicester, aren't
well,
they?
Well, yeah. No, this is what I was, because I was trying to find out, because I knew that they were a great band that were just really, in a way, unjustly forgotten. You know, they need to be brought back to the limelight, as it were, and people to know about them. So anyway, it was somebody called Min Scarlett arranged for Jimmy Miller to produce their first single.
Right.
So, and Steve Winwood and other members of Traffic played on it as well, obviously because they came in with Jimmy Miller.
Mm.
So, and John Peel was a big fan.
Yeah, because it was that John Peel type of thing, because it's like slightly unusual, edgy, you know. And you listen to it, you can always tell it's fun, but you can tell with his voice and the arrangements and the guitars. Beautiful, yeah.
Sorry.
Fantastic.
But it is like that. No, what a great band. Check them out, family. And I think, actually, darling, it's that time again. It's coming to the end of the show.
No, it's gone so quick.
Oh, yeah, I know. I've had a really good time this week, actually. But if you want to get in contact with us, we're on Instagram at Starlight Campbell. Twitter is at Susie and Simon. That's S-U-Z-Y and Simon. And, of course, on Facebook.
Yeah, and the show is available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio in the US. Please tell your friends.
Indeed.
And now we're going to play out on a...
I love this track, actually. You play this as well.
Yeah.
The Allman Brothers.
Yeah, I love it. Written by Dickie Betts after the sad demise of Duane Allman.
Yeah.
Because Greg Allman was still in the band, you know, as a keyboard player and stuff. Butch Trucks on drums for this. But Duane was dead.
Yeah.
So Dickie Betts took over as band leader, I think. And he designed the riff to be played like Django Reinhardt would play it, because he only used two fingers. It can be played with two fingers. I can't play with two fingers. Well, I don't play with two fingers. I play with three, actually. But it's a real, you know, it's a classic song, lovely melody. And was it written about his daughter?
Daughter, Jessica, yeah.
Right.
Indeed. And also it was used as the theme tune for a long time for Top Gear.
Yeah. So, see you next time.
Onwards.